seeming to confirm their hypothesis. Women continue to express greater upset about a partner's emotional infidelity, Buss writes, even if it did not involve sex. Men continue to show more upset than women about a partner's sexual infidelity, even if it did not involve emotional involvement. But despite the apparent cross-cultural breadth of this research, it lacks methodological depth. Buss and his colleagues succumb to the same temptation that weakens so much sexuality research: reliance on a subject population more convenient than representative. Almost all the participants in these studies were university students. We understand that undergraduate students are low-hanging research fruit, easy for graduate students to locate and motivate by offering partial course credit for filling out a questionnaire, for example, but this does not make them valid representatives of human sexuality. Far from it. Even in supposedly liberal Western cultures, college-age people are in the early stages of their sociosexual development, with little if any experience to draw on when considering questions about one-night stands, long-term mate preferences, or their ideal number of lifetime sexual partners, all questions explored in Buss's research. But Buss is not alone in this distorting focus on undergrads. The majority of research on sexuality is based upon the responses of 18 to 22-year-old American university students. While one could make a case that a 20-year-old guy is more or less like a turbocharged 50-year-old, few would argue that a 20-year-old woman has much in common with a woman 3 decades older in terms of her sexuality. Most would agree that a woman's sexuality changes considerably throughout adulthood. Another problem with using college students in the sort of multicultural study Buss conducts concerns class distinctions. In underdeveloped countries, university students are likely to be from the upper classes. A wealthy Angolan student may have a lot more in common with a Portuguese undergrad than with someone his or her own age living in the slums of Luanda. Our own field research in Africa suggests that sexual beliefs and behavior differ greatly among social classes and subcultures there, as they do in other parts of the world. Beyond the distorting effects of age and class, Buss and his colleagues skip over the crucial fact that every one of their subjects lives in post-agricultural societies characterized by private property, political hierarchies, globalized television, and so on. How can we expect to identify human universals without including at least a few foragers whose thoughts and behaviors have not been shaped by the effects of modern life and whose perspective represents the vast majority of our species' experience? As we've established, plenty of research on foragers demonstrates important similarities among unrelated societies and dramatic differences from post-agricultural norms. Swedes and upper-class Nigerians may see themselves as different from one another, but from a forager's perspective, they would seem similar in many ways. Granted, it is no easy matter to airdrop questionnaires and number 2 pencils to foragers in the upper Amazon. The grad students must be crazy. Still, the difficulty or impossibility of including their perspective does nothing to lessen its vital importance to the integrity of this sort of research. This broad yet shallow research paradigm is like claiming to have uncovered universal fish truths after conducting studies in rivers around the world. What about the fish in lakes, ponds, oceans? Psychologist Christine Harris has noted that Buss's conclusions could easily be nothing more than confirmation of old news, that men are more reactive to any form of sexual stimuli than they are to emotional stimuli, and are more interested in or better able to imagine such stimuli. The men get more agitated by the sex, in other words, simply because they imagine it more clearly than the women do. When Harris measured the bodily responses of people being asked Buss's questions, she found that women as a group showed little difference in physiological reactivity, but they still predicted, almost unanimously, that the emotional infidelity would be more disturbing for them. This finding suggests a fascinating disconnect between what these women actually feel and what they think they should feel about their partner's fidelity. Psychologists David A. DeSteno and Peter Salovey found even more fundamental flaws in Buss's research, pointing out that the subject's belief system comes into play when answering questions about hypothetical infidelity. They note that the belief that emotional infidelity implies sexual infidelity was held to a greater degree by women than men, and that therefore the choice between sexual infidelity and emotional infidelity at the heart of Buss's studies is a false dichotomy. David A. Lischner and his colleagues honed in on another weak point. The fact that subjects are given only two options, either thoughts of sexual infidelity hurt more, or thoughts of emotional infidelity do. Lischner asked, what if both scenarios made subjects feel equally uncomfortable? When Lischner included this third option, he found that the majority of respondents indicated that both forms of infidelity were equally upsetting, throwing further doubt on Buss's conclusions. Buss and other evolutionary psychologists who argue that some degree of jealousy is part of human nature may have a point, but they're overplaying their hand when they universalize their findings to everyone, everywhere, always. Human nature is made of highly reflective material. It is a mirror, admittedly marked by unalterable genetic scratches and cracks, but a mirror nonetheless. For most human beings, reality is pretty much what we're told it is. Like practically everything else, jealousy reflects social modification and can clearly be reduced to little more than a minor irritant if consensus deems it so. Real science offers one of the few, if not the only, reliable means of seeing beyond such cultural distortions, which makes it vitally important that we be fearless in rooting out cultural bias in research. Among the Siriano of Bolivia, jealousy tends to arise not because one's spouse has lovers, but because he or she is devoting too much time and energy to those lovers. According to anthropologist Alan Holmberg, romantic love is a concept foreign to the Siriano. Sex, like hunger, is a drive to be satisfied. The expression sukubi, I like, is used in reference to everything the Siriano enjoy, whether food, jewelry, or a sexual partner. While there are, of course, certain ideals of erotic bliss, Holmberg found that, under conditions of desire, these readily break down, and the Siriano are content to conform to the principle of any port in a storm. Anthropologist William Crocker is convinced that Canela husbands are not jealous, writing, "Whether or not Canela husbands are telling the truth about not minding, they join with other members in encouraging their wives to honor the custom of ritual sex with 20 or more men during all community ceremonies." Now, anyone who can pretend not to be jealous as his wife has sex with 20 or more men is someone you do not want to meet across a poker table. The cultures we've reviewed, from steamy jungles in Brazil to lakeside Himalayan foothills, have each developed mechanisms for minimizing jealousy and sexual possessiveness. But the opposite also happens. Some cultures actively encourage the impulse toward possessiveness. How to tell when a man loves a woman. Written by Percy Sledge and first recorded in 1966, When a Man Loves a Woman hit a cultural nerve. The song shot to the top of both the Billboard Hot 100 and R&B charts. Another version, recorded 25 years later by Michael Bolton, also went straight to the top of the charts, and the song now sits at number 54 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Nothing is more prominent than love and sex in Western media, and When a Man Loves a Woman is an example of the message whispered in romantic ears throughout the world. What does Mr. Sledge have to say about a man's love for a woman? What are the signs of true masculine love? Copyright restrictions won't allow us to quote the song's lyric in full, but most readers know the words by heart anyway. To review, when a man loves a woman, he becomes obsessed and can't think of anything else. He'll exchange anything, even the world, for her company. He's blind to any fault she may have, and will abandon even his closest friend if that friend tries to warn him about her. He'll spend all his money trying to hold her attention. And, last but not least, he'll sleep in the rain if she tells him to. We'd like to suggest an alternative title for this song. When a man becomes pathologically obsessed and sacrifices all self-respect and dignity by making a complete ass of himself and losing the woman anyway because, really, who wants a boyfriend who sleeps out in the rain because someone told him to? Similarly, Every Breath You Take sits at a respectable number 84 on Rolling Stone's list of all-time great songs. One of the biggest hits of 1983, the song topped the UK charts for a month and the US charts for two. It won Song of the Year, and The Police won that year's Grammy for Best Pop Performance. To date, the song has logged in over 10 million registered airplays on radio stations around the world. Again, we're assuming you know the words, but have you ever really listened to them? Though often held up as one of the great love songs of all time, Every Breath You Take is not about love at all. Sung from the perspective of a man who's been rejected by a woman who refuses to acknowledge that she belongs to him, he says he's going to follow her every step, watch her every move, see who she spends the night with, and so on. This is a love song? It should be number one on Billboard's ranking of Crazed and Dangerous Stalker songs. Even Sting, who wrote the song after awakening in the middle of the night with the line, "Every breath you take, every move you make," bubbled up from his subconscious, didn't realize until later how sinister the song is. He suggested in an interview that he may have been thinking of George Orwell's 1984, a novel about surveillance and control, certainly not love. So is jealousy natural? It depends. Fear is certainly natural, and like any other kind of insecurity, jealousy is an expression of fear. But whether or not someone else's sex life provokes fear depends on how sex is defined in a given society, relationship, and individual's personality. Firstborn children often feel jealous when a younger sibling is born. Wise parents make a special point of reassuring the child that she'll always be special, that the baby doesn't represent any kind of threat to her status, and that there's plenty of love for everyone. Why is it so easy to believe that a mother's love isn't a zero-sum proposition, but that sexual love is a finite resource? Evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins asks the pertinent question with characteristic elegance. Is it so very obvious that you can't love more than one person? We seem to manage it with parental love. Parents are reproached if they don't at least pretend to love all their children equally. Love of books, of food, of wine. Love of Chateau Margaux does not preclude love of a fine hawk, and we don't feel unfaithful to the red when we dally with the white. Love of composers, poets, holiday beaches, friends. Why is erotic love the one exception that everybody instantly acknowledges without even thinking about it? Why indeed? How would the prevalence and experience of jealousy be affected in Western societies if the economic dependence trapping most women and their children didn't exist, leading female sexual access to be a tightly controlled commodity? What if economic security and guilt-free sexual friendships were easily available to almost all men and women, as they are in many of the societies we've discussed, as well as among our closest primate cousins? What if no woman had to worry that a ruptured relationship would leave her and her children destitute and vulnerable? What if average guys knew they'd never have to worry about finding someone to love? What if we didn't all grow up hearing that true love is obsessive and possessive? What if, like the Mwoswo, we revered the dignity and autonomy of those we loved? What if, in other words, sex, love, and economic security were as available to us as they were to our ancestors? If fear is removed from jealousy, what's left?
Human beings will be happier. Not when they cure cancer, or get to Mars, or eliminate racial prejudice, or flush Lake Erie, but when they find ways to inhabit primitive communities again. That's my utopia. Kurt Vonnegut Jr.
According to E.O. Wilson, all that we can surmise of humankind's genetic history argues for a more liberal sexual morality, in which sexual practices are to be regarded first as bonding devices and only second as a means for procreation. We couldn't have said it better. But if human sexuality developed primarily as a bonding mechanism, in interdependent bands where paternity certainty was a non-issue, then the standard narrative of human sexual evolution is toast. The anachronistic presumption that women have always bartered their sexual favors to individual men in return for help with childcare, food, protection, and the rest of it, collapses upon contact with the many societies where women feel no need to negotiate such deals. Rather than a plausible explanation for how we got to be the way we are, the standard narrative is exposed as contemporary moralistic bias, packaged to look like science, and then projected upon the distant screen of prehistory, rationalizing the present while obscuring the past. Yabba dabba do. Part 3. The Way We Weren't. A central theme in our argument is that human sexual behavior is a reflection of both evolved tendencies and social context. Thus, a sense of the day-to-day social world in which human sexual tendencies evolved is essential to understanding them. It's hard to imagine the communal, cooperative social configurations we've described surviving long in the kind of world Hobbes envisioned, characterized by bellum omnium contra omnes, the war of all against all. But the false view of prehistoric human life summed up in Hobbes's pithy dictum, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, is still almost universally accepted. Having established that prehistoric human life was highly social and decidedly not solitary, we now briefly address the other elements in Hobbes's description in the following four chapters, before continuing with a more direct discussion of overtly sexual material. We hope readers primarily interested in sex will bear with us, because what might at first seem a detour is in fact a shortcut to a clearer vision of the day-to-day lives of our ancestors, a vision that will help you make better sense of the material that follows, as well as of your own world. Chapter 11. The Wealth of Nature. Poor?
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, has marked the upward surge of mankind. Gordon Gekko, in the film Wall Street. What constitutes misuse of the universe? This question can be answered in one word. Greed. Greed constitutes the most grievous wrong. Laurenti Magesa. African Religion. The Moral Traditions of Abundant Life.
Economics, the dismal science, was dismal right from the start. On a late autumn afternoon in 1838, what may have been the brightest bolt of illumination ever to flash out of an overcast English sky struck Charles Darwin right upside the head, leaving him stunned by what Richard Dawkins has called the most powerful idea that has ever occurred to a man. At the very moment the great insight underlying natural selection came to him, Darwin was reading An Essay on the Principle of Population by Thomas Malthus. If the measure of an idea is its endurance through time, Thomas Malthus deserves his spot as Wikipedia's 80th most influential person in history. More than two centuries later, one would be hard-pressed to find a single student of economics unfamiliar with the simple argument put forth by the world's first professor of economics. You'll recall that Malthus argued that each generation doubles geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, but farmers can only increase food supply arithmetically, as new fields are cleared and productive capacity is added in a linear fashion, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. From this crystalline reasoning follows Malthus's brutal conclusion. Chronic overpopulation, desperation, and widespread starvation are intrinsic to human existence. Not a thing to be done about it. Helping the poor is like feeding London's pigeons. They'll just reproduce back to the brink of starvation anyway, so what's the point? The poverty and misery which prevail among the lower classes of society, Malthus asserts, are absolutely irremediable. Malthus based his estimates of human reproductive rates on the recorded increase of European population in North America in the previous 150 years, 1650 through 1800. He concluded that the colonial population had doubled every 25 years or so, which he took to be a reasonable estimate of the rates of human population growth in general. In his autobiography, Darwin recalled that when he applied these dire Malthusian computations to the natural world, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result of this would be the formation of new species. Here, then, I had at last got a theory by which to work. Science writer Matt Ridley believes Malthus taught Darwin the bleak lesson that overbreeding must end in pestilence, famine, or violence, convincing him that the secret of natural selection was embedded in the struggle for existence. Thus was Darwin's brilliance sparked by the darkest Malthusian gloom. Alfred Russel Wallace, who came up with the mechanism underlying natural selection independently of Darwin, experienced his own flash of insight while reading the same essay between bouts of fever in a hut on the banks of a malarial Malaysian river. Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw smelled the Malthusian morbidity underlying natural selection, lamenting, "When its whole significance dawns on you, your heart sinks into a heap of sand within you." Shaw lamented natural selection's hideous fatalism and complained of its damnable reduction of beauty and intelligence, of strength and purpose, of honor and aspiration. But while Darwin and Wallace made excellent use of the Malthus's dire calculations, there's a problem with them. They don't add up.
The tribes of hunters, like beasts of prey, whom they resemble in their mode of subsistence, will be thinly scattered over the surface of the earth. Like beasts of prey, they must either drive away or fly from every rival, and be engaged in perpetual contests with each other. The neighboring nations live in a perpetual state of hostility with each other. The very act of increasing in one tribe must be an act of aggression against its neighbors, as a larger range of territory will be necessary to support its increased numbers. The life of the victor depends on the death of the enemy. Thomas Malthus, An Essay on the Principle of Population.
If his estimates of population growth were even close to correct, Malthus, and thus Darwin, would have been right to assume that human societies had long been necessarily confined in room, resulting in a perpetual state of hostility with one another. In Descent of Man, Darwin revisits Malthus's calculations, writing, "Civilized populations have been known under favorable conditions, as in the United States, to double their numbers in 25 years. At this rate, the present population of the United States, 30 millions, would in 657 years cover the whole terraqueous globe so thickly that 4 men would have to stand on each square yard of surface." If Malthus had been correct about prehistoric human population doubling every 25 years, these assumptions would indeed have been reasonable. But he wasn't, and they weren't. We now know that until the advent of agriculture, our ancestors' overall population doubled not every 25 years, but every 250,000 years. Malthus, and thus Darwin after him, was off by a factor of 10,000. Malthus assumed the suffering he saw around him reflected the eternal, inescapable condition of human and animal life. he didn't understand that the teeming, desperate streets of London circa 1800 were far from a reflection of prehistoric conditions. A century and a half earlier, Thomas Hobbes had made the same mistake, extrapolating from his own personal experience to conjure a mistaken vision of prehistoric human life. Thomas Hobbes was born to terror. His mother had gone into premature labor upon hearing that the Spanish Armada was about to attack England. "My mother," Hobbes wrote many years later, "gave birth to twins, myself and fear." Leviathan, the book in which he famously asserts that prehistoric life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, was composed in Paris, where he was hiding from enemies he'd made by supporting the crown in the English Civil War. The book was nearly abandoned when he was taken with a near-fatal illness that left him at death's door for 6 months. Upon publication of Leviathan in France, Hobbes's life was now being threatened by his fellow exiles, who were offended by the anti-Catholicism expressed in the book. He fled back across the Channel to England, begging the mercy of those he'd escaped 11 years earlier. Though he was permitted to stay, publication of his book was prohibited. The church banned it, Oxford University banned and burned it. Writing of Hobbes's world, cultural historian Mark Lilla describes Christians addled by apocalyptic dreams, who hunted and killed Christians with a maniacal fury they had once reserved for Muslims, Jews, and heretics. It was madness. Hobbes took the madness of his age, considered it normal, and projected it back into prehistoric epochs of which he knew next to nothing. What Hobbes called human nature was a projection of 17th-century Europe, where life for most was rough, to put it mildly. Though it has persisted for centuries, Hobbes's dark fantasy of prehistoric human life is as valid as grand conclusions about Siberian wolves based on observations of stray dogs in Tijuana. To be fair, Malthus, Hobbes, and Darwin were constrained by the lack of actual data. To his enormous credit, Darwin recognized this and tried hard to address it, spending his entire adult life collecting specimens, taking copious notes, and corresponding with anyone who could provide him with useful information, but it wasn't enough. The necessary facts wouldn't be revealed for many decades. But now we have them. Scientists have learned to read ancient bones and teeth, to carbon date the ash of Pleistocene fires, to trace the drift of the mitochondrial DNA of our ancestors, and the information they've uncovered resoundingly refutes the vision of prehistory Hobbes and Malthus conjured and Darwin swallowed whole.
Poor, pitiful me. We are enriched not by what we possess, but by what we can do without. Immanuel Kant.
If George Orwell was correct that those who control the past control the future, what of those who control the distant past? Prior to the population increases associated with agriculture, most of the world was a vast, empty place in terms of human population. But the desperate overcrowding imagined by Hobbes, Malthus, and Darwin is still deeply embedded in evolutionary theory and repeated like a mantra, "Facts be damned." For example, in his recent essay entitled Why War?, philosopher David Livingstone Smith projects the Malthusian panorama in all its mistaken despair. "Competition for limited resources is the engine of evolutionary change," he writes. "Any population that reproduces without inhibition will eventually outstrip the resources upon which it depends, and, as numbers swell, individuals will have no alternative but to compete more and more desperately for dwindling resources. Those who can secure them will flourish, and those who cannot will die." True, as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far, because Smith forgets that our ancestors were the original ramblin' men and women, nomads who rarely stopped walking for more than a few days at a stretch. Walking away is what they did best. Why assume they would have stuck around to struggle desperately in an overpopulated area with depleted resources when they could simply walk up the beach as they'd been doing for uncounted generations. And prehistoric human beings never reproduced without inhibition, like rabbits. Far from it. In fact, prehistoric world population growth is estimated to have been well below 0.001% per year throughout prehistory, hardly the population bomb Malthus assumed. Basic human reproductive biology in a foraging context made rapid population growth unlikely, if not impossible. Women rarely conceive while breastfeeding, and without milk from domesticated animals, hunter-gatherer women typically breastfeed each child for 5 or 6 years. Furthermore, the demands of a mobile hunter-gatherer lifestyle make carrying more than one small child at a time unreasonable for a mother, even assuming lots of help from others. Finally, low body fat levels result in much later menarche for hunter-gatherer females than for their post-agricultural sisters. Most foragers don't start ovulating until their late teens, resulting in a shorter reproductive life. Hobbes, Malthus, and Darwin were themselves surrounded by the desperate effects of population saturation, rampant infectious disease, ceaseless war, Machiavellian struggles for power. The prehistoric world, however, was sparsely populated, where it was populated at all. Other than isolated pockets surrounded by desert, or islands like Papua New Guinea, the prehistoric world was almost all open frontier. Most scholars believe that our ancestors were just setting out from Africa about 50,000 years ago, entering Europe 5 or 10,000 years later. The first human footprints probably weren't left on North American soil until about 12,000 years ago. During the many millennia before agriculture, the entire number of Homo sapiens on the planet probably never surpassed 1 million people and certainly never approached the current population of Chicago. Furthermore, recently obtained DNA analyses suggest several population bottlenecks caused by environmental catastrophes reduced our species to just a few hundred individuals as recently as 70,000 years ago. Ours is a very young species. Few of our ancestors faced the unrelenting scarcity-generated selective pressures envisioned by Hobbes, Malthus, and Darwin. The ancestral human journey did not, by and large, take place in a world already saturated with our kind, fighting over scraps. Rather, the route taken by the bulk of our ancestors led through a long series of ecosystems with nothing quite like us already there. Like the Burmese pythons recently set loose in the Everglades, cane toads spreading unchecked across Australia, or the timber wolves recently reintroduced to Yellowstone, our ancestors were generally entering an open ecological niche. When Hobbes wrote that man to man is an errant wolf, he was unaware of just how cooperative and communicative wolves can be if there's enough food for everyone. Individuals and species spreading into rich new ecosystems aren't locked in a struggle to the death against one another. Until the niche is saturated, such interspecies conflict over food is counterproductive and needless. We've already shown that even in a largely empty world, the social lives of foragers were anything but solitary. But Hobbes also claimed prehistoric life was poor, and Malthus believed poverty to be eternal and inescapable. Yet most foragers don't believe themselves to be impoverished, and there's every indication that life wasn't generally much of a struggle for our fire-controlling, highly intelligent ancestors bound together in cooperative bands. To be sure, occasional catastrophes such as droughts, climatic shifts, and volcanic eruptions were devastating, but most of our ancestors lived in a largely unpopulated world chock-full of food. For hundreds of thousands of generations, the omnivore's dilemma facing our ancestors lay in choosing among many culinary options. Plants eat soil, deer eat plants, cougars eat deer. But people can and do eat almost anything, including cougars, deer, plants, and, yes, even soil.
The despair of millionaires. Poverty is the invention of civilization. Marshall Sahlins.
A recent New York Times article under the headline, "In Silicon Valley, Millionaires Who Don't Feel Rich," begins, "By almost any definition, except his own and perhaps those of his neighbors here in Silicon Valley, Hal Steger has it made." The article notes that although Mr. Steger and his wife have a net worth of roughly $3.5 million, he still typically works 12-hour days plus another 10 hours on weekends. "A few million," explains Steger, "doesn't go as far as it used to." Gary Kremen, estimated net worth $10 million, founder of Match.com, an online dating service, explains, "Everyone around here looks at the people above them." He continues to work 60 to 80 hours per week because, he says, "You're nobody here at $10 million. Another executive gets right to the point, saying, "Here, the top 1% chases the top 1/10 of 1%, and the top 1/10 of 1% chases the top 1/100 of 1%. This sort of thinking isn't limited to Silicon Valley. A BBC report from September 2003 reported, "Well off is the new poor." Dr. Clive Hamilton, a visiting scholar at Cambridge University, set out to study the suffering rich and found that 4 of every 10 people earning over £50,000, roughly $80,000 at the time, felt deprived. Hamilton concluded, "The real concerns of yesterday's poor have become the imagined concerns of today's rich." Another recent survey in the United States found that 45% of those with a net worth, excluding their home, over $1 million, were worried about running out of money before they died. Over 1/3 of those with more than $5 million had the same concern. Affluenza, aka luxury fever, is not an eternal affliction of the human animal, as some would have us believe. It is an effect of wealth disparities that arose with agriculture. Still, even in modern societies, we sometimes find echoes of the ancient egalitarianism of our ancestors. In the early 1960s, a physician named Stuart Wolfe heard about a town of Italian immigrants and their descendants in northeast Pennsylvania where heart disease was practically unknown. Wolfe decided to take a closer look at the town, Roseto. He found that almost no one under age 55 showed symptoms of heart disease. Men over 65 suffered about half the number of heart problems expected of average Americans. The overall death rate in Roseto was about 1/3 below national averages. After conducting research that carefully excluded factors such as exercise, diet, and regional variables like pollution levels, Wolf and sociologist John Brunn concluded that the major factor keeping folks in Roseto healthier longer was the nature of the community itself. They noted that most households held 3 generations, that older folks commanded great respect, and that the community disdained any display of wealth, showing a fear of ostentation derived from an ancient belief among Italian villagers relating to malocchio, the evil eye. Children, Wolf wrote, were taught that any display of wealth or superiority over a neighbor would bring bad luck. Noting that Roseto's egalitarian social bonds were already breaking down in the mid-1960s, Wolf and Brunn predicted that within a generation, the town's mortality rates would start to shift upward. In follow-up studies they conducted 25 years later, they reported, "The most striking social change was a widespread rejection of a long-standing taboo against ostentation, and that sharing, once typical of Roseto, had given way to competition. Rates of both heart disease and stroke had doubled in a generation." Among foragers, where property is shared, poverty tends to be a non-issue. In his classic book, Stone Age Economics, anthropologist Marshall Sahlins explains that the world's most primitive people have few possessions, but they are not poor. Poverty is not a certain small amount of goods, nor is it just a relation between means and ends. Above all, it is a relation between people. Poverty is a social status. As such, it is the invention of civilization. Socrates made the same point 2,400 years ago. He is richest who is content with least, for contentment is the wealth of nature. But the wealth of civilization is material. After reading every word of the Old Testament, journalist David Plotz was struck by its mercantile tone. The overarching theme of the Bible, he wrote, particularly of Genesis, is real estate. God is constantly making land deals and then remaking them on different terms. It's not just land that the Bible is obsessed with, but also portable property, gold, silver, livestock. Malthus and Darwin were both struck by the characteristic egalitarianism of foragers, the former writing, "Among most of the American tribes, so great a degree of equality prevailed that all the members of each community would be nearly equal sharers in general hardships of savage life and in the pressure of occasional famines." For his part, Darwin recognized the inherent conflict between the capital-based civilization he knew and what he saw as the natives' self-defeating generosity, writing, "Nomadic habits, whether over wide plains or through the dense forests of the tropics or along the shores of the sea, have in every case been highly detrimental. The perfect equality of all the inhabitants," he wrote, "will for many years prevent their civilization." Finding contentment at the bottom of the scale of human beings. Looking for an example of the world's most downtrodden, pathetic, desperately poor savages, Malthus cited the wretched inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego, who had been judged by European travelers to be at the bottom of the scale of human beings. Just 30 years later, Charles Darwin was in Tierra del Fuego observing these same people. He agreed with Malthus concerning the Fuegians, writing in his journal, "I believe if the world was searched, no lower grade of man could be found." As chance would have it, Captain Robert Fitzroy of the Beagle, the ship on which Darwin was sailing, had picked up three young Fuegians on an earlier voyage and brought them back to England to introduce them to the glories of British life and a proper Christian education. Now, after they'd experienced firsthand the superiority of civilized living, Fitzroy was returning them to their own people to serve as missionaries. The plan was for them to show the Fuegians the folly of their savage ways and help them join the civilized world. But just a year after Jemmy, York, and Fuegia had been returned to their people at Woolya Cove, near the base of what is now called Mount Darwin, the Beagle and her crew returned to find the huts and gardens the British sailors had built for the three Fuegians deserted and overgrown. Eventually, Jemmy appeared and explained that he and the other Christianized Fuegians had reverted to their former way of living. Darwin, overcome with sadness, wrote in his journal that he'd never seen so complete and grievous a change, and that it was painful to behold him. They brought Jemmy aboard the ship and dressed him for dinner at the captain's table, much relieved to see that he at least remembered how to use a knife and fork properly. Captain Fitzroy offered to bring him back to England, but Jemmy declined, saying he had not the least wish to return to England, as he was happy and contented with plenty fruits, plenty fish, and plenty birdies. Remember the Yucatan. What looks like even extreme poverty, the bottom of the scale of human beings, may contain unrecognizable forms of wealth. Recall the starving Australian Aboriginal people, happily roasting low-fat rats and noshing on juicy grubs, as revolted Englishmen looked on, certain they were witnessing the last demented spasms of starvation. When we start detribalizing, peeling away the cultural conditioning that distorts our vision, wealth and poverty may reveal themselves where we least expect to find them. Chapter 12. The Selfish Meme. Nasty? Richard Dawkins, author of The Selfish Gene, coined the term meme to refer to a unit of information that can spread through a community via learning or imitation, the way a favored gene is replicated through reproduction. Just as egalitarianism and resource and risk-sharing memes were favored in the prehistoric environment, the selfishness meme has flourished in most of the post-agricultural world. Even so, no less an authority on economics than Adam Smith insisted that sympathy and compassion come to human beings as naturally as self-interest. The faulty assumption that scarcity-based economic thinking is somehow the de facto human approach to questions of supply, demand, and distribution of wealth has misled much anthropological, philosophical, and economic thought over the past few centuries. As economist John Gowdy explains, rational economic behavior is peculiar to market capitalism and is an embedded set of beliefs, not an objective universal law of nature. The myth of economic man explains the organizing principle of contemporary capitalism, nothing more or less.
Homo economicus. We have agreed with which we have agreed. Society by Eddie Vedder.
Many economists have forgotten or never understood that their central organizing principle, Homo economicus, aka economic man, is a myth rooted in assumptions about human nature, not a bedrock truth upon which to base a durable economic philosophy. When John Stuart Mill proposed what he admitted to be an arbitrary definition of man as a being who inevitably does that by which he may obtain the greatest amount of necessaries, conveniences, and luxuries, with the smallest quantity of labor and physical self-denial, it's doubtful he expected his arbitrary definition to delimit economic thought for centuries. Recall Rousseau's words, "If I had had to choose my place of birth, I would have chosen a state in which everyone knew everyone else, so that neither the obscure tactics of vice nor the modesty of virtue could have escaped public scrutiny and judgment." Those who proclaim that greed is simply part of human nature too often leave context unmentioned. Yes, greed is part of human nature, but so is shame, and so is generosity, and not just toward genetic relatives. When economists base their models on their fantasies of an economic man motivated only by self-interest, they forget community, the all-important web of meaning we spin around each other, the inescapable context within which anything truly human has taken place. One of the most cited thought experiments in game theory and economics is called the prisoner's dilemma. It presents such an elegant and simple model of reciprocity, some scientists refer to it as the E. coli of social psychology. Here's how it works. Imagine that two suspects are arrested, but the police don't have enough evidence for a conviction. After the prisoners are separated, each gets the same offer. If you testify against your partner and he remains silent, you'll go free and he'll get the full 10-year sentence. If he fesses up but you don't, you'll do the time while he walks free. If neither of you talks, you'll both get 6 months. If you both talk, you'll both do 5 years. Each prisoner must choose to snitch or remain silent. Each is told the other won't know about his decision. How will the prisoners respond? In the classic form of the game, participants almost always betray one another as each sees the benefit of quick betrayal. Talk first and walk away free. But take that theoretical conclusion to a prison anywhere in the world and ask what happens to rats. Theory finally caught up to reality when scientists decided to let players gain experience with the game and see whether their behavior changed over time. As Robert Axelrod explains in The Evolution of Cooperation, players soon learned that they had a better chance if they kept quiet and assumed that their partner would do the same. If their partner talked, he acquired a bad reputation and was punished in a tit-for-tat pattern. Over time, those players with the more altruistic approach flourished, while those who acted only in their individual short-term interest met serious problems, a shiv in the shower, maybe. The classic interpretation of the experiment took another blow when psychologist Gregory S. Burns and his colleagues decided to wire female players up to an MRI machine. Burns et al. Were expecting to find that subjects would react most strongly to being cheated when one tried to cooperate and the other snitched. But that's not what they found. "The results really surprised us," Burns told Natalie Angier of the New York Times. "The brain responded most energetically to acts of cooperation. The brightest signals arose in cooperative alliances and in those neighborhoods of the brain already known to respond to desserts, pictures of pretty faces, money, cocaine, and any number of licit and illicit delights." Analyzing the brain scans, Burns and his team found that when the women cooperated, two parts of the brain, both responsive to dopamine, were activated. The anteroventral striatum and the orbital frontal cortex. Both regions are involved in impulse control, compulsive behavior, and reward processing. Though surprised by what his team found, Burns found comfort in it. "It's reassuring," he said. "In some ways, it says that we're wired to cooperate with each other." The Tragedy of the Commons. First published in the prestigious journal Science in 1968, biologist Garrett Hardin's paper, The Tragedy of the Commons, is one of the most reprinted articles ever to appear in a scientific journal. The authors of a recent World Bank discussion paper called it the dominant paradigm within which social scientists assess natural resource issues. While anthropologist G.N. Appel says the paper has been embraced as a sacred text by scholars and professionals. Well into the 1800s, much of rural England was considered commons, property owned by the king but available to everyone, like the open range in the western United States before the advent of barbed wire fencing. Using the English commons as his model, Hardin purported to show what happens when a resource is communally owned. He reasoned that in a pasture open to all, each herdsman will try to keep as many cattle as possible. Though destructive to the pasture, the herdsman's selfishness makes good economic sense from his personal perspective. Hardin wrote, "The rational herdsman will conclude that the only sensible course for him to pursue is to add another animal to his herd. This is the only rational choice, because all will share the cost of the degradation to the land from overgrazing, while the profit gained from additional animals will be his alone. Since each individual herdsman will come to the same conclusion, the common ground will inevitably be overgrazed. Freedom in a commons," Hardin concluded, "brings ruin to us all." Like Malthus's thoughts on population growth relative to agricultural capacity, Hardin's argument was a hit because, one, it features an A plus B equals C simplicity that appears to be inarguably correct, and two, it is useful in justifying seemingly heartless decisions by entrenched powers. Malthus's essay, for example, was often cited by British business and political leaders to explain their inaction in the face of widespread poverty in Britain, including the famine of the 1840s, in which several million Irish people starved to death and millions more fled to the United States. Hardin's articulation of the folly of communal ownership has provided cover repeatedly to those arguing for the privatization of government services and the conquest of native lands. One other thing Hardin's elegant argument has in common with that of Malthus: it collapses on contact with reality. As Canadian author Ian Angus explains, Hardin simply ignored what actually happens in a real commons, self-regulation by the communities involved. Hardin missed the fact that in small rural communities where population density is low enough that each of the herdsmen knows the others, the actual case in the historical English commons and in ancestral foraging societies, any individual who tries to game the system is quickly found out and punished. Nobel Prize-winning economist Eleanor Ostrom's studies of commons management in small-scale communities led her to conclude that all communities have some form of monitoring to to guard against cheating or using more than a fair share of the resource. Despite how it's been spun by economists and others arguing against local resource management, the real tragedy of the commons doesn't pose a threat to resources controlled by small groups of interdependent individuals. Forget the commons. We need to confront the tragedies of the open seas, skies, rivers, and forests. Fisheries around the world are collapsing because no one has the authority, power, and motivation to stop international fleets from strip mining waters everybody, and thus nobody, owns. Toxins from Chinese smokestacks burning illegally mined Russian coal lodge in Korean lungs. While American cars burning Venezuelan petroleum melt glaciers in Greenland. What allows these chain-linked tragedies is the absence of local, personal shame. The false certainty that comes from applying Malthusian economics, the prisoner's dilemma, and the tragedy of the commons to pre-agricultural societies requires that we ignore the fine-grained contours of life in small-scale communities where nobody could have escaped public scrutiny and judgment, in Rousseau's words. These tragedies become inevitable only when the group size exceeds our species' capacity for keeping track of one another, a point that's come to be known as Dunbar's number. In primate communities, size definitely matters. Noticing the importance of grooming behavior in social primates, British anthropologist Robin Dunbar plotted overall group size against the neocortical development of the brain. Using this correlation, he predicted that humans start losing track of who's doing what to whom when group size hits about 150 individuals. In Dunbar's words, the limit imposed by neocortical processing capacity is simply on the number of individuals with whom a stable interpersonal relationship can be maintained. Other anthropologists had arrived at the same number by observing that when group sizes grew much beyond that, they tend to split into two smaller groups. Writing several years before Dunbar's paper was published in 1992, Marvin Harris noted, "With 50 people per band or 150 per village, everybody knew everybody else intimately, so that the bonding of reciprocal exchange could hold people together. People gave with the expectation of taking, and took with the expectation of giving." Recent authors, including Malcolm Gladwell in his best-selling The Tipping Point, have popularized the idea of 150 being a limit to organically functioning groups. Having evolved in small intimate bands where everybody knows our name, human beings aren't very good at dealing with the dubious freedoms conferred by anonymity. When communities grow beyond the point where every individual has at least a passing acquaintance with everyone else, our behavior changes, our choices shift, and our sense of the possible and of the acceptable grows ever more abstract. The same argument can be made concerning the tragic misunderstanding of human nature that underlies communism. Community ownership doesn't work in large-scale societies where people operate in anonymity. In The Power of Scale, anthropologist John Bodley wrote, "The size of human societies and cultures matters because larger societies will naturally have more concentrated social power. Larger societies will be less democratic than smaller societies, and they will have an unequal distribution of risks and rewards." Right, because the bigger the society is, the less functional shame becomes. When the Berlin Wall came down, jubilant capitalists announced that the essential flaw of communism had been its failure to account for human nature. Well, yes and no. Marx's fatal error was his failure to appreciate the importance of context. Human nature functions one way in the context of intimate interdependent societies, but set loose in anonymity, we become a different creature. Neither beast is more nor less human.
Dreams of perpetual progress. He is a barbarian, and thinks that the customs of his tribe and island are the laws of nature. George Bernard Shaw, Caesar, in Caesar and Cleopatra, Act 2.
Were we really born in the best possible time and place? Or is ours a random moment in infinity, just another among uncountable moments, each with its compensating pleasures and disappointments? Perhaps you find it absurd to even